So, good morning. I'm substituting for Geshe-la this morning. I'm a poor substitute. He's not feeling well, but he will be here at 10:45. I guess that's the 10:45 session. So, before we get started, let's do three prostrations. Those of you who are new or who feel uncomfortable or are not used to it. You don't have to. There's no requirement. But basically, we do the prostrations to show, to show reverence for the Buddha's teachings, the Buddhas themselves and their teachings, because we can only hope to gain their sublime qualities at some point in our lives or in our future lives. And so we show respect for him and them and their teachings, that that we may be like them. So that's really what it is. So let's just do three prostrations and then we'll start. So we'll start with a short meditation. And if you're familiar with meditating, then you know what to do. If you haven't, that's fine. I think the main goal is to keep our bodies in a relatively relaxed posture, but straight. And we can use an object of our breath, which is, we can just concentrate on the breath, the in and the out, and just try to stay focused on that. And hope and try not to have our minds wander. And if they wander, we just bring them back to the breath gently. So that's essentially it. So we'll just start with that for a few minutes. Come into that, we can use His Holiness the Dalai Lama's technique of three deep breaths to expel the unbalanced energy that might be in our mind stream. So let's start with a few prayers. If you will turn to the peach colored sheet, I guess that's peach, cream colored sheet. So let's start with Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, and we'll do the four immeasurables in English and then in Tibetan. You know, I used to know a different tune. If I started coming to the center, and so I can never keep track of which tune we're doing. So why don't you start? You know the tune, and I'll follow. Mune, mune, maha, munae, so. Of happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Good morning. You know, when Sarah called me up and said, you know, Geshe-la is not well, would you do the Sunday morning? And I thought, you know, yeah, I can, but what am I going to talk about, you know? Because they didn't really tell me what to talk about. And so, but it reminded me, or I was at the time, I was studying this text and it reminded me of, some of you were here when Venerable Rene was here, a few months ago, right? And so one time many years ago, a bunch of his students, me included, and he were in this, in this discussion, I guess. And we were, I don't remember the topic we were discussing. It was a debate, really, actually. It was a debate. I don't remember exactly what it was about, maybe on reality or something like that, wisdom maybe. Anyway, and so, we were all, there was five or six of us, and we were all debating back and forth and pointing out mistakes in the other one's arguments and so forth and so on. And, he's kind of sitting there quietly, and some of us are raising our voices, and I'm kind of, I was kind of looking to see, okay, I wonder what he's thinking, Because he's not saying anything at all. He's kind of just watching it. And then he kind of said, we'd been going on back and forth like this for about 10 minutes. And then he says very quietly, he says, all of you really know a lot, but do you put it into practice? right? So, you know, you've learned a lot, but does it make any difference in your lives? And, you know, and it kind of really shut us up. And so I was thinking about that, and all of us are kind of like that. You know, we have a wonderful academic understanding of the spiritual path. You know, those of us who have been engaged in it for a while. But it's difficult to say how much of it really permeates our soul, I guess, our minds. In Buddhist terminology, it'll be our minds. In other word terminology, it'll be our soul. And that kind of, you know, and so when Sarah called me up and said, would you do this? And I was thinking, what should I talk about? And so then I thought, you know, I'm kind of leading the Discovering Buddhism classes, this module. Some of you are in there, I see. And it's about transforming problems. Right? The topic is transforming problems. And that's really what it's about, right? This whole body of teaching, which is about how to make the teachings central in our lives, how to live based on those teachings, and whether or not our lives become more fruitful or better. Are we better people? I guess that's the bottom line, right? Are we better people? And so it's about transforming problems. I thought, okay, maybe, you know, this morning we can talk about that. You know, maybe you've solved it already, you know, which is wonderful if you have. I don't mean that as a joke, really. I mean, I think, you know, what some of you in here, I'm sure, are quite accomplished practitioners. I wouldn't know by looking at you because we can't tell, right? You know, somebody once told me, he said, you know, if somebody says he's a Buddha, chances are most likely he's not. You know, you can trust that he's not, right? So I don't know, you know, one of you may, you know, some of you are probably accomplished practitioners and you may have, you know, made, you know, so in that case, I apologize if I'm repeating what you already know. But anyway, so I thought that, you know, if we get to it, we could talk about the 8 verses of thought transformation, which is this really amazing, 8 verses that encapsulate all of the Buddha's teachings and how to transform our lives, right? Transform our minds, transform our problems. So if we think about what does it mean to transform? First of all, to figure out how to transform our problems, we have to understand what problems are, right? I mean, a lot of us don't think we have any problems, actually. Or at least we live our lives as if we don't have any problems, or we push them under the rug and we pretend. But, you know, the question is, what are problems? The Buddha talked about, you know, he used the term dukkha, the Sanskrit term dukkha, which is translated into English as suffering, which doesn't quite mean suffering. You know, dukkha basically means it's a combination of this constant or underlying sense of dissatisfaction that we have, of sorrow, of maybe even misery, I don't know. But just, you know, if you'll notice that if you have nothing to do, our minds automatically just try to think of, okay, what am I going to do now? Should I turn on the TV and kind of just blob out, engage myself? You know, somehow we look outward. You know, that's that, you know, when we don't have any problems, we have that at least. Right? So that's the kind of underlying, we have this simmering sense of dissatisfaction. And then most of the time we have these waves of problems on the waves when they go up. And then on the way down, we have some period of not having problems, maybe even joy sometimes. They seem to be few and far between. And so, you know, so the Buddha talked about suffering. And, you know, so we have to kind of figure out, number one, that do we have suffering? And the Buddha says, yes, we do. That our lives are, you know, birth, aging, sickness, and death. Right, that's what he used. And then, of course, in between, we have lots of not physical ailments, but emotional distress, right? Whether with our families, whether with our work, whether with our anything, right? With society or people around us. Or just in our, we have mental, our own inner issues, right? Our own mental problems, maybe, mental illnesses even, right? So there's all that stuff in between, birth, aging, sickness, and death. And the question is that, how do we get there? Why do we have those problems, right? And what the Buddha said was that if you examine these issues, if you really look deeply, one finds, so it's like peeling an onion, right? So you see the outer layer, and you see the problems that we see on a daily basis, and you kind of look, examine, you take some time, and you examine, and you meditate, and you, etc., like the Buddha did. And he said that underlying it, the one reason is that all of our actions, whether mental or physical, is governed by the eight worldly concerns, right? The eight worldly concerns are four concerns and their opposites, right? So we want material wealth, or the opposite is we don't want poverty, right? Or not having wealth, material gain. So gain and loss is the first one. So second one is comfort and hardship, right? So that's second one. Third one, we want praise, and we don't want blame. And the fourth one is we want good reputation, right? We want people to treat us with, you know, we have respect for us, good reputation. And the opposite, you know, of, you know, people not, yeah, maybe despising us or scornful or whatever it is, you know, whatever the opposite is. So those are the four, those are the eight worldly concerns. And so if you look at our lives, everything that we do is governed by those eight worldly concerns. And it's, so you can take examples, you know. I mean, you know, we buy fancy cars because we want to feel like we have a good reputation, I guess, or we want to show we have material wealth, right? We have arrived. Or, you know, when we get a promotion, you know, we want promotions because one reason, of course, is that we want to strive, which is good. We need to strive, right? We need to fulfill our potential. That's definitely true, right? And the Buddha himself said that, right? Whatever our potential is, whatever we're good at, we should do the best job we can, and we should strive. So that's certainly good. But most of the time, we want the promotion not because we want to do a better job or... But, you know, there's other things involved, and you can, you know, there's a lot of other stuff, right? So, you know, we feed ourselves, for example, because we need to feed ourselves, the Buddha said, because we're not of benefit to anybody if we just die, right? I mean, we have a precious human birth, so we have to make sure that we sustain ourselves. But most of the time, we don't just feed ourselves. We feed ourselves with, as you said, with gluttony. Right? We're gluttons. Actually, one of the food offering prayers, when Buddha Geshe-la does the food offering prayers, he does it in Tibetan. But if you read the English translation, it says, "May I eat this food, you know, without feeling of superiority, etc., etc." One of the words is without gluttony. Right. So we just feed ourselves enough, but not too much. Right. So things like that. There's a lot of everything that we do. There's the eight worldly concerns in there. And so we're kind of like, one of my teachers said, you know, we're kind of like animals. We're not that different, you know. The animals, we say, oh, yeah, they're lower beings because they're driven by instinct, right? But for us, the eight worldly concerns are instinctual. You know, we really don't think twice about it. I mean, we don't even think, period, right? I mean, Until I read the Buddha's The Eight Worldly Concerns, I never thought about it. It never even occurred to me to think about it, really. So it was instinctual for me, certainly. Right? So he said there's the Eight Worldly Concerns. And then he said, but that's not enough, right? That's not the root of it, right? So when you look at the Eight Worldly Concerns, the reason we engage in all these things and we have these concerns is because of two things, which is attachment and aversion, right? So attachment, they're both two sides of the same coin. Attachment basically means that we want more of something that we like, and aversion is we want less of something that we dislike, right? So now we can go back to our examples in our lives, and we see that everything that we do is about like and dislike, and wanting more or less of either one, right? And that's usually partly because we have this inflated sense of self, right? I want the fancy car because I want to exaggerate my view of myself, I guess. Yeah, my view of the construction. You know, how we have defined ourself is a construction, right? Of our minds, of our perception of the world, right? That's what the Buddha said. And so, you know, we have this we want to exaggerate our sense of self. So we buy the fancy car, we want the better promotion, we are resentful of other people who may get the promotion but we didn't. Because certainly we deserve it, right? More than they do, I would expect, right? You know, I should get paid more than the other person because, well, hell, I'm much better than they are, right? So, and everything else, right? All the other stuff that we do, you know, better looking girlfriends, you know, next wife or next husband. I mean, whatever, you pick it, right? It's all based on that. It's somebody else's fault because I deserve better. So, so that's the sense of self. So you have attachment, you have the eight worldly concerns. Then underlying it, you have attachment aversion. Underlying it, you have the sense of self. And then he said, underlying it, that of course is the root of it all, which he defined as ignorance. And so ignorance is, so I won't go too much into it, because that's just a gigantic topic. I'm not even sure I'm not the right person anyway. But ignorance is basically this, so ignorance is, in English is defined as just not being aware of something, right? Not knowing something. But ignorance that the Buddha used was different. He actually, his meaning of ignorance was that we create this this view, whether of ourselves, whether of others, or phenomena in general, right? We create this view, a deluded view, based on the deluded perceptions that we have, right? Based on the obscurations in our minds, right? So we have created this deluded view of ourselves and of others and of just in general of the world around us. So that's number one, right? And number two, we believe it to be true. Right? Those are the two things in ignorance, right? It's not just being not aware of the truth, or not aware of the true nature of reality. It's that we have a mistaken view of reality, and then we say, oh, that's got to be it. That is the way it is, period. Right? So underlying it, that's what it comes down to. All of the, everything else is like built on top of it. Right? So when we take actions based on a deluded view, it's contaminated action. It's called contaminated action because it's created by a mind that's a contaminated mind, contaminated by delusions. That's what it means. Doesn't mean that we are bad people. It just means our minds are deluded. And so our actions are based out of delusions. So they create negative seeds in our minds, which come to ripen to fruition at some point in this life or future lives, which is the sorrow or dukkha or suffering that we finally end up with. Right? So that's how it kind of pervades our existence. And so the question is, you know, so how do we transform it, right? Until we become Buddhas ourselves, or great bodhisattvas at least, you know, so there are Arya beings who basically are beyond karma, right? Because they have realized the true nature of reality. You know, they don't have this, you know, Geshe-la has been using the, I don't know if some of you have been coming to his teachings in the last few Sundays, or before he, he's been using the example of a magician. I don't know if you're familiar. So basically a magician, you know, this is a classic analogy that's used in the scriptures, and maybe even the Buddha used it, I'm not exactly sure. But a magician, you know, he creates this apparition, you know, in the air, you know, of a elephant or a horse is usually the, you know, elephant or a horse out of a stone, you know, so there's a stone on the ground, and he creates this illusion of a elephant. And so there's an audience, right? And so everybody in the audience believes that horse to be there, right? And that's all they see, and that's what they believe. Wow. The magician, on the other hand, well, the magician sees the horse, right? Because he created it. But he also sees the stone, right? He sees the two things, but he sees them together, right? And so the Arya beings are like, we, of course, are like the audience, right? We see the elephant and we believe it to be true. It's a deluded vision, view, but we believe it to be true. The magician, on the other hand, like an Arya being, sees both things simultaneously, right? There's some term they use. But anyway, they see it together. They're inseparable, but they also see both angles, both sides of it, right? Once you're like that, you're beyond karma, right? You're beyond this constant creation of negative seeds, etc. And you don't have any ripening of negative karma, right? So once we get to that point, you know, until we get to that point, we're going to have problems, right? And so the question is, how do we make the most of it and also continue to be of benefit? How do we make the best of it and transform it so that we can create the causes to continue on our spiritual path, on our spiritual growth, that we can realize, you know, the qualities of the Buddhas, that we can become Buddhas ourselves, because we all have the potential, right? That's one of the central things of Buddhism, is that we all have the Buddha potential. We will all become Buddhas one day, some a little bit faster than others, because we may be a little bit faster, you know, a little bit further along in our spiritual growth, but we all will at sooner or later. So the question is, how do we stay on that trajectory? Because we want to get there as fast as we can, not just for ourselves, because we want to be of maximum benefit to others, right? Because there will be lots of other people and animals who will not have become Buddhas, and we can help them along the way, right? So how do we transform the problems, right? And so what the best way, the Buddha said, and as if you come on May 3rd, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche will say, is that the best way to do this is by cherishing others. It's the fastest way, the quickest way, the simplest way, and the most, you know, I don't know, the most effective way. You know, we can do, you know, like Rinpoche himself will say, you know, we can do great high practices and all this other stuff, but if we don't have the mind of cherishing others, it is of very little benefit. You know, we're doing the mantras. It has probably some benefit, but if it doesn't have the attitude of being of benefit to others and of cherishing others, then it really really doesn't go very far. It doesn't matter, you know, if you do the Omani mantra or if you're doing the Guja Samaja Tantra and all this other fancy stuff, right? That's what it comes down to. And so, and in Rinpoche's words, you know, cherishing others is like a, he says, a rocket missile at the self-cherishing mind, which is the, you know, which is the root of our problems, right? Ignorance, exaggerated sense of self, right? That governs everything, the me and the my and the mine. How dare you? You know, if you attack my friend, I will exact revenge. But if it's a stranger, I couldn't care less, right? Or if it's my enemy, I'm glad, right? If you attack my enemy, I'm happy. Good riddance, right? So the cherishing others is the antidote, right? They say, to the self-grasping mind that we have. And, you know, so, and the benefits of cherishing others are just great. You know, I actually was, you know, I was reading this, I took some notes, believe it or not. I normally don't, but I actually prepared for this. But anyway, so, I liked this quote. This is from, there's a book, wonderful book called Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage by a very high Lama, Geshe Jampa Tekchor. And so I was reading that book a few months ago and I took this down in my notes, and he said, even in the few cases when others have harmed us, seeking revenge is self-defeating. He said, since death is definite and the time of death is indefinite, wanting to harm others makes no sense. It's like the squabbling of prisoners condemned to death, right? So it's interesting, you know. I mean, it's kind of an interesting viewpoint. You know, we have these small lives in a way, right? We have, I don't want to say that's not a right term either, but I mean, our lives, you know, from day to day, we have these small things that we. We have a short view, a small view, you know? We don't take the long view. And if you take the long view, that's what he's talking about here, is that, you know, our death is the long view, right? Or at least medium-term view, actually. But for us, it's a very long view. And, you know, the small, petty squabbles that we have on a daily basis, you know, it means absolutely nothing. It's totally counterproductive, right? It's like prisoners squabbling at the time, you know, right before execution, right? And so, especially for us, you know, I mean, prisoners at least may know their time of execution. We don't know our time of our time of death, right? I might keel over, you know, write this next sentence before I even, you know, read the next thing, right? Could happen. I mean, it has happened, right? So like that. I mean, in that book, he also says, you know, why, you know, what is the benefit of cherishing others, right? He says our mind will become very peaceful and happy, which makes sense, right? If we don't engage in the petty squabbles all the time, or always just concerned with the eight worldly concerns, the normal cares, the normal things that really get us, just go away. We will stop fighting the world in a futile attempt to have everything and everyone conform to our desires. Geshe Luce, you know, says, my way or the highway. That's the one, right? Everything good and excellent, both temporarily and ultimately, comes in dependence upon other beings. So at a relatively shallow level, it's because, you know, everything that we need to live, to survive, we have to depend on others, right? But at a deeper level, to gain our ultimate, we depend on others. For example, we depend on the people around us in the center, for example, right, for our spiritual growth, right? They help us in our path. They encourage us. When we are discouraged, they help us, right? So all those things. But then on top of that, you know, the Buddhas, for example, and the Bodhisattvas, for example, need beings to actually love and cherish for them to become. You can't gain those qualities if you don't have people to actually practice it on, right? You know, it's interesting. I was on a trip with Venerable Rene last time he was here. We went over to the mountains for a few days. And on the way, he was telling me, you know, we were visiting a friend of ours who is a monk who now lives there. And he's an elder monk. You know, he's an older than Venerable Rene. Venerable Rene is in his mid-50s, and he's this... Venerable George, actually, some of you may know him. Venerable George is probably in his late 60s. And Venerable Rene, you know, he was buying all. So he said, let's stop at a grocery store. We buy all these fruits and stuff, you know. Get some fruits and bring some things to him, right? As an offer. He said, you know, because there are not very many elder monks left. He said, there are only a few older than me from the old crowd, the original crowd with Lama Yeshe. There's only maybe a handful of monks, 4 or 5 or 6, older than him, you know, that same group of people. And he said, you know, you guys get lots of chances to make offerings, you know, and get the benefit, right? You have teachers you make offerings to and et cetera, you know. But I don't have very many people to make offerings to. You know, so when I see somebody older than me, I always make offerings because, you know, that's the only way that I can grow, right? Accumulate merit, you know, through generosity and so forth and so on, right? For him, you know, he doesn't see Rinpoche very often, maybe every couple of years. He doesn't see other monks very often, anybody older. It's just like that, you know? So he himself needs other beings on his path, right? So like that, we depend on others, right? So anyway, so there's lots of, you know, the root, you know, but that's the, you know, so there's many, many benefits of cherishing others. And so the question is, you know, how do we transform, how do we cherish others, right? And so there's this great, great text called the 8 Verses of Mahayana Thought Training, which, you know, you can just Google and you'll find. And Rinpoche, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, has a translation of it. So I'm kind of just going through that, you know. So the first one, it says, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I shall hold them most dear at all times. And so it's interesting, you know, it says, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. You know, so the question is, why are they precious and dear? Right? So they're precious and, you know, the reason they're precious and dear, why we should consider them precious and dear? Because the scriptures say that, number one, they're just like us. Right? They want the same things we do. You know, what is that? There's a quote in Merchant of Venice, you know, if you prick us, do we not bleed? You know, because Shylock is the Jew, right? And he's talking to, I can't remember, the well, the Gentiles, but in general, but I can't remember the characters now. But he says, you know, if you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you harm us, shall we not revenge? Yes. Shall we not avenge? Yes. So it's like that, you know, which is, shall we not avenge? That's then that becomes something else, you know. But the others are just like us, you know. So we see them as different than us because they've mistreated us in some way or so forth and so on. But deep down, as His Holiness says, I'm a simple monk and they... And you know, and he is just like me. There's no difference. So that's one reason, right, to hold them precious and dear. But also, there's a deeper reason, which is, you know, as we study more, we gain this, you know, there's the idea that, you know, if we've had countless lives, as they say, right? If we've had countless lives, then at some point in our past, all beings around us have been our mothers at some point or other, right? Or fathers, or pick whoever you feel close to. So they've been mothers, our mothers at some point. So how can we value them any less just because in this life we don't see them as our mother, right? But they have been our mother just like our current, in this life, our mother is... has loved us and we feel close to in this life. Why would we differentiate? Right? So there's the idea of the mother sentient beings. And so, you know, so that's why we have to hold them precious and dear, and they're like the wish fulfilling jewel, because if we practice great compassion and love towards them, it propels us towards being, you know, towards Buddhahood, right? Towards spiritual growth. To, you know, the two accumulations of merit and wisdom without which we cannot become Buddhas, right? We cannot grow spiritually. It doesn't matter what tradition you're in, you have to still accumulate merit and wisdom, right? And so other sentient beings, if we consider them mothers and if we have practiced love and compassion to them, that's an incredibly powerful way of accumulating merit, and the wisdom comes along with it. The next verse says, when in the company of others, I shall always consider myself... No, when in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. So that's a kind of an interesting one, because, you know, people get hung up on the lowest, I shall consider myself the lowest of all. And what this is talking about is pride. You know, in Buddhist thought, pride is actually a negative mental. There's these, you know, 51 mental factors, and pride is one of them. And that's a negative mental. You know, there are positive mental factors. Pride is a negative mental factor, and the reason is that the pride that they talk about is not necessarily the English word pride, but the pride they're talking about is the exaggerated sense of self, right? The self-importance at the cost of others. That's the pride that they're talking about. Because that's usually the pride that we feel. You know, we are proud of our work or proud of our behavior. Quite often that we are, you know, truly... we're gratified by, you know, that's self-appreciation. And, you know, one can use the term self-appreciation. You know, we are very appreciative of how we conducted ourselves. And that's a good thing, right? That's a positive thing. But most of the time, our pride is actually at the cost of others. How much better I am. Better I am, you know, than the next person, right? And that pride actually feeds our self-grasping and self-cherishing, which is, again, the root of our problems. Because, you know, every time we feel pride, how much better we are, we will denigrate others, and which continues to feed that kind of, you know, just... You know, I'll tell you, you know, one time, not one time, but many years ago, you know, almost 20 years ago, I was living in California. I only moved here, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. So I was living in California in San Francisco. And I was going to the centers there. And, you know, I was doing relatively well, you know, financially. And so I thought I deserved a fancy car. You know, I kind of deserved it. I'd arrived, you know. I'm kind of embarrassed about it, but anyway, but it is what it is, you know. So anyway, so I kind of bought this, which I still have, and it's a 20-year-old car now. It drives great. I still have it, but it's kind of totally run down now, so there's no status in it now. You know, it's faded, and it's banged up, and brakes don't, well, brakes work, but the other stuff doesn't work. But anyway, but it still works pretty well. So anyway, so I had this fancy car, and, you know, and but the interesting thing I noticed was when I drove down the road in the car, I felt superior. You know, I bought the car because I did feel superior. And as I was driving the car, it fed my feeling of superiority. And, you know, I would notice the other cars. You know, it was interesting. I would notice what other people were driving. And it's a very, you know, it kind of feeds itself. And now I just drive a Subaru, you know, wagon. It has no status whatsoever. And, you know, it's interesting. I just, you know, it does bring, you know, what Geshe Tekchok said about, you know, he said, it brings calm, peace of mind and calmness, you know, cherishing others brings peace of mind and calmness. It's true, you know, once I got rid of, well, once I don't drive, I have the car, but I don't drive it very much. You know, I don't have that sense of, you know, I don't notice the other cars very much. I don't worry about what other people are driving. You know, I don't, it's very interesting how it works. And so, you know, so that's the pride that he's, so he's saying that, what they're saying is, when in the company of others, I should always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart, hold others dear and supreme. It's talking about this humility, right? You know, the one interesting thing they say is that, you know, we feel great pride when we have achieved that promotion, or we have, you know, got the fancy car, or whatever it happens to be, right? And what Rinpoche says is that, you know, when you think about it, it's not, you know, we feel proud because it's a result of our actions, right? I mean, result of, you know, I do a wonderful job and I, whatever, et cetera, and I get the promotion, right? And what Rinpoche said is that, you know, you feel really proud about it or you feel superior, but the thing is that it's not because of the result of just that action, you know, just this in this life, you know, most of this karma. Almost all karma, when you study, you find that it's actually a result of actions in previous lives. There are very, very few karma that actually the results ripen in the current life. Almost, you know, there's only a couple of them. And there's a few more that result immediately in the next life. And everything else basically is in some other future life, right? So whatever we're really proud of right now, that something that's happened that's good, or bad for that matter, but in this case, you know, we're talking about something good that happens that we feel proud of. It's actually a result of something we did many lifetimes ago. So it really has very little connection in a way. I mean, our doing a good job creates a cause and condition for the promotion to happen, right? I mean, there is that, you know. I mean, if we did a poor job, if we sat at home and watched TV all day, we wouldn't get a promotion, right? I mean, so we create the cause for the promotion, but the reason we're getting the promotion is for something that happened many lifetimes ago. Right, so the pride that we feel about being superior, you know, now that we're managing a whole bunch of people and, well, how great I am, it's actually because of something else. So this really, it's not, we inflate ourselves, but it's not because of, not that much because of what we did here. And so, you know, so we have to really value the other's good fortune, you know, hold others dear and supreme, right, it says. And value others with true goodwill. You know, I think that's what they're talking about, right? How often are we really happy when something good happens to somebody else? I mean, in our family, maybe we, you know, if it's something really good happens to our children, we feel very happy. We rejoice. You know, true happy. You know, true sense of rejoicing. But outside of our immediate family, you know, if it happens to our next door neighbor or if it happens to our coworker or whatever, how often are we happy? Really, truly, you know, not happy that, you know, I mean, you know, there's that kind of happiness which is like, good, he's become a manager now, so he's not going to, I don't have to report to him anymore, you know, I'm really happy. That's not what we're talking about, right? Something really nice that happened and we really, truly rejoice, right, for them. It doesn't happen very often, if ever. So all of these things, I'm running out of time, but I mean there's six other verses and you can read them, but the thing is that what they're saying is that if we are able to bring these teachings into our hearts, and if we're able to live by practicing the teaching on a daily basis, on a second-by-second basis, right? Whatever actions we take, if we examine, truly examine, and see why we're taking our actions, and is it positive, or what is the motivation behind it, right? Then our lives will be transformed. And it's not because what we will do will be different, which it will be, right? But the interesting thing is that if we cherish others, if we truly cherish others, people will interact with us differently. You know, it's very difficult to be vengeful, angry, impatient with someone who is actually exudes love and compassion. It's just not possible. I mean, we as human beings, if we are of relatively sane minds, right, we're not going to be able to react to somebody like that. So if we actually change ourselves, others around us will change themselves, change their behavior with us, right? So it automatically, it's not just a benefit to us. So it's a benefit to us, certainly, right? Because we have calmer and peaceful, more peaceful lives and peaceful minds. And our future lives become more conducive to spiritual growth. We have human rebirths and we have, you know, like now, we have the we have conducive environment like we have now to continue our spiritual growth, right? So we will continue to reap those benefits, right? That's certainly true. But we also bring benefit to others because they change themselves. You know, think about that, right? I mean, it's just a side effect, right? We haven't even tried to change them, right? But they basically change because around us, they can't do anything else. I mean, I know a couple of people like, it's very difficult. You know, you can't really be angry with them because they're just, you know that their actions are coming from a different place. So if we're able to practice these things, then our lives will be transformed. That's what the Buddhas have promised us, right? And that's what Geshe-la talks about every Sunday. And that's why we really have to open ourselves and hear what he is saying and really take it into our hearts, because everything else that we do is a worldly benefit, right? It'll end very soon. In some way or other, it'll end very soon. One way or other, it'll end. You know, either it ends of its own accord or it ends with our death, right? So whatever we do of worldly benefit, it ends very soon. But what Geshe-la talks about every Sunday is basically the one that continues, the unending, right? It's the ones that'll save us or help us in all our future existences, right? You know, if we take a long view, that's what it is, right? That's the long view. If we have to think about it from the long view. I'll do one more verse. In the next verse it says, vigilant, the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, I shall confront and avert it without delay. vigilant the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others. I shall confront and avert it without delay. So vigilance is actually one of those mental factors, and it's a positive mental factor because it's a thing that guards the door toward from all negative things, right? So it's, you know, I think Geshe-la said this. I don't know who said this, but you know, but Geshe-la said that, you know, he said that, you know, when we're very protective of, you know, what touches our body or our private space, you know, like if you're in a subway or whatever, there's that private space. If somebody comes next to too close to you, we get really, you know, we protect ourselves, right? Or he says, you know, if you have a hurt arm or something, you really protect it. You don't want anybody coming next to you, right? Or us. I mean, when I say you, I mean me too. And but he said that, you know, we'll let just about anything come into our minds. We won't stop anything. We'll be perfectly happy to let anything enter our minds. Right? And if you think about it, the mind is the central thing here, right? Because karma is intention, right? Karma is, that's all it is. It's not the action that causes the seeds, right? It's the intention that causes. Because if you think about it, the action of giving, right? If I give to someone, I can give with intention of being of, you know, being of just true sense of generosity. May it be of help, you know, may it help the person, whatever I'm doing, right? Or I can give out of pride, right? I have so much more than this guy, you know, how much better I am, right? Same action, but has two totally different karmic seeds. So it's not the action that is that it creates the karmic seed. It's the intention, right? So the intention is all in our mind stream. It's all in our minds. So if we let any old junk enter our minds, that's the cause of all our problems. You know, all that feeds our delusion, creates it feeds that exaggerated sense of self, and so forth, and on we go, right? So that's why it's so important to be vigilant, and that's why it's a positive mental factor, because negative thoughts will usually create negative results, and positive thoughts will create positive results. That's basically the bottom line, right? And so we have to examine our motivation at all times. Whatever we do, we have to be clear why we're doing it. And that's why meditation and so forth and so on really helps, because when we are about to engage in any action, whether, you know, mental action or physical action, you know, if we are practice meditation, if we have an ongoing practice, then it creates a space right before the action to actually have the examination. You know, otherwise they become instinctual, right? Our actions become instinctual. We have no time between some event and the reaction, right? But if we have an ongoing practice and we have a meditative practice and we, et cetera, study and practice, then we have that gap between the action and the reaction. And during that gap, we can engage with ourselves and we say, well, see what we're really doing and why we're doing it. And maybe we do the same thing. We would do the same thing over again, which is fine. Maybe that's the right thing to do, right? But at least we should be aware of why we're doing it, right? Instead of just doing it, you know, like a doctor hitting us on the knee, right? Knee-jerk reaction. That's it. There we go. And so if we don't counter attachment, it spins its story. This is Geshe Thakur said this. If we don't counter attachment, it spins its story and makes the attachment stronger. It feeds on itself. And so then we, you know, have the anger, the jealousy, the, you know, on and on and on. He said, you know, so one of the, you know, for those of you who are aware of the five aggregates, so one of them is discrimination, right? So we engage with the object. So discrimination, you know, that's a quality we have as human beings. Oh boy, I'm out of time, so I'll finish after this. So, discrimination, we have a quality as human beings, right, which animals don't have. We can discriminate between right and wrong, likes and dislikes, and so forth and so on, right? So we engage with the object, we build expectations, and it's all in our minds, right? So when the expectations don't, when things don't come out exactly the way we expected, then comes all the discouragement, the depression, the anger, jealousy, all this other stuff. And all this is because of our karmic seeds, right? It's mental seeds that we've created because we haven't been vigilant. So yeah, so that's kind of the... So anyway, so if you're interested, you can look up 8 verses of Mahayana thought training. That's what the verses are called. And you can read it. His Holiness has... Actually, if you go to Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive, you know, which is on lamayeshe.org, I think, is their website. They have a commentary by His Holiness Dalai Lama. Short, actually. Short and very readable one. By His Holiness Dalai Lama on the eight verses of Mahayana thought training. So it's quite nice. Okay. So before we end, let's do our dedication prayers. So we'll do, let's see, we'll go to the back of the cream-colored sheet, and we'll do the, no, oh, we're going to the pink sheet, right. And so we'll do the dedication verses from the pink sheet. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies goodness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatare, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold a subduer's moral way, who serve as a bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And we'll do the Green Tara Mantra for Geshe-la's long, happy life. Oh, I know a different tune, so you have to start. Tu tare tu re so ha. Om tare tu tare tu re so ha. Om 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 tare tu tare tu re so ha. Thank you very much. Have a good weekend.